I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Since the start of the year, two ambulance services in the Northeast Kingdom have had to shut down, in Derby Line and Barton. Both had financial struggles of different sorts, but it's left a hole in that part of the state when it comes to emergency calls. Other squads are filling in the gaps, but still, it's a concern. What is the long-term future for ambulance service in that part of the state? And while the situation in the most northeasterly part of Vermont is perhaps more acute than elsewhere at the moment, the question of who will respond to emergency calls is an open one statewide. There's a patchwork of different services, some professional, some volunteer, the payment levels vary, but there are pressures on all of them. We're going to look at that issue today, and we're going to start by getting more details on the situation in the NEK. Joining me from the Barton Chronicle now is reporter Joseph Gresser. Joseph, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So can you explain what happened with Derby Line Ambulance and then again in Barton?
Well, the situation in Derby was an odd one. There was a case where the treasurer had been embezzling money. They never really recovered from that. And at the end of last year, it was discovered that they had been failing to give the IRS withholding money, and they had a lien on them for $155,000. That pretty much spelled the end for the squad, and Newport Ambulance took over a lot of their area.
So that's what happened in Derby Line, and again, that was at the very beginning of the year, and more recently, there was a closure, and it's unclear yet, I think, whether it's permanent or not in Barton?
It's pretty clear that it's permanent. The Barton squad had a problem both with finances, but really more to do with finding qualified people to staff the ambulances. And I think more than anything else, this is what is driving thoughts of consolidation and just concerns about how the area will be served.
And what happens now when someone in Barton calls in an emergency?
An ambulance comes.
It may not.
It doesn't come from Barton, but depending on where the person is in the Barton area, it may come from Glover or from the Orleans squad.
So, Joseph, when you look at these two particular situations, do they speak to a larger issue, do you think, or are they very specific to these two emergency departments, two EMT and ambulance departments, and sort of not a part of a larger picture?
Well, there is a larger picture. These squads had their own problems, but we've been reporting for the past 5 or 6 years about financial struggles that all the departments have had to one degree or another, partly having to do with lower reimbursement rates from Medicare and Medicaid, a tax imposed by the state. But really, so many of these ambulance services were set up originally as volunteer squads, and that depended on having qualified people who were near enough to the ambulance building to respond when a call came in. With the decline of farming, with more people working farther away from home, there are fewer people who are able to respond in a timely manner. And also, the requirements for certification have increased. And that's not a bad thing, because it's an indication that what ambulance crews are able to do to help a person in distress is much greater than it used to be because of medical advances. But still, to get someone trained to the level where they can be responding is something that's both time-consuming and expensive, and fewer people are qualified to do it than they were in the days when group of people in a town might buy an old hearse and just be taking people with a broken leg or other distress to the hospital.
So given that, and given the situation that we find ourselves in the modern world, What kind of conversations are happening about what might be the future of emergency services and volunteer squads in the Northeast Kingdom and beyond?
Well, there's the beginning of a conversation. In February, a lot of representatives of towns and ambulance services met in Derby Line to discuss things. I think there's a general understanding that if you were to start from scratch, you wouldn't have the patchwork that you have now. On the other hand, ambulance squads are made up of very proud people, and rightly so. These are people who do really good work. They serve their communities selflessly. So to persuade people to give up their identity and to combine is going to take a lot of diplomacy, and it's going to be a hard thing to do. But I think it's pretty clear that there is going to have to be some kind of rationalization to make sure that the right equipment and the right people are in the right place all the time. And at least one service, which is the Newport Ambulance, has reacted over the years by becoming a purely professional service. Most of the other ambulance services in the area are a combination of a few professional people and a large number of volunteers. And that very much depends on the individual circumstances of the community.
So does it sound like there's a little bit of a consensus forming that perhaps squads will have to be regionalized and professional? And of course, by professional, we mean not the level of skill necessarily that EMTs have, but whether this is what your job is, you're doing this as a career, or you're doing it as mostly a volunteer, even if you get paid a little bit.
Yes, that's my understanding of it, although the people who are professional tend to be able to get more training and are at a higher level. I don't know whether there's a consensus. I think this is something that has to yet to be seen. I know that there are beginning to be discussions, and the outcome of them will really depend on how well what is going on now works. I mean, if it continues to work well, then I don't think there will be a strong push for consolidation. If other ambulance companies find themselves in the kind of situation that spelled the demise of Derby Line and Barton Ambulance, there could be a lot more pressure.
Joseph Gresser is a reporter for the Barton Chronicle, and he's been covering the situation with the two ambulance departments that have had to stop service this year in Derby Line and Barton, and the communities and squads that are filling in the gaps. Joseph, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
And in the studio with me here in VPR's Montpelier Bureau now is Dan Batesy, EMS Chief with the Vermont Department of Health. It's nice to have you on the show, Dan.
Good afternoon.
So what we just heard from Joseph was this situation, you know, that is in some ways particularly acute because two squads closing in one part of the state within several months of each other and other squads coming in to sort of fill in the gaps, Newport filling in Derby Line and Orleans and Glover filling in Barton. But it is a bigger problem, isn't it, this pressure on ambulance services and emergency squads around the state?
Yeah, for sure. I think Mr. Gresser gave a very good synopsis of what's going on, and it is not limited to the Northeast Kingdom. There's a lot of small services that are struggling throughout Vermont. But I think what you also mentioned before is very important too, that we can't paint this with one brush. There's a lot of things that are going on out there that are very successful, and there's services that are thriving and have enough volunteers. And I think we as a system have to respond to those situations individually. Well, we need to support what's working, and we need to fix what's not working.
Yes, it sounds easy the way you say it like that.
Of course,
that.
No problem.
Can you lay out that patchwork? I mean, Joseph Gresser mentioned we probably wouldn't create it this way if we were starting from scratch, but what is the system and how does it work?
Well, so if you've seen one ambulance service, you've seen one ambulance service, and really across the state we do it in a lot of different ways. We have first response services that respond without transporting people to the hospital. We have
In other words, they don't have an ambulance.
That's
so
correct.
They'll show up. It's an emergency, you know, volunteer squad, and they'll show up and triage, and an ambulance will come from somewhere
else. That's right.
They
partner with another ambulance to provide that transport. Then we have transporting services, and those range from municipal services to nonprofit corporations that are formed to just provide the ambulance, and they range from big to small and everything in between. And what you see across that is a big combination. Most of our services have some level of paid staff. In fact, of all the ambulance services we have, a little over half of them, a little bit more than half, are of that combined model where they have some volunteers and they have some paid people.
And then when you say paid people, I want to be clear here, mm-hmm. because sometimes volunteer EMTs will get like either, you know, reimbursement for mileage, or they'll get sort of a stipend, which is not a salary. But
no.
You're talking about a combined squad where some people are basically on staff.
Sure. Well, we have both, right? So there are services that will have just a stipend or some sort of a per diem kind of reimbursement. But then we have other services that do have a dedicated paid staff, but also supplement it with volunteers as well. And that's, like I said, across the state, it really varies from place to place. And we see a lot of different models out there.
Is it working by and large?
Well, so I think overall, and I think we should be really clear that when people call 911, the ambulance comes. And I think although it is patched together, as they said, I think overall it is working quite well. We're not missing calls in general, and people are getting the services they need. I think they're getting it at a high quality as well. But that said, I think we have to look to the future and help create a vision for where we go from here. We can't recreate we can't scrub it and say, let's start all over again. That's not possible. But I think we can put some planning and some vision behind it and say, how do we avoid some of the problems like we saw in Derby Line and Barton as well?
If I hear from you that if I need to call 911 because I need an ambulance, I'm going to get one, why do I care if there are challenges? Because it sounds like, you know, if I'm just out for myself, I'm great. I'm going to get a good ambulance. It's going to come in the right amount of time, and I may even get somebody there to help me out beforehand.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, that's the problem we have, is we're so good at our job that no one really thinks about how it gets done. And the complexity is how it gets done. When an ambulance service closes, for example, the burden goes to the other surrounding communities, and oftentimes those surrounding communities are doing everything they can just to get the ambulance out the door and don't always have the capacity to take on more calls. The other thing with regard to that is when we sort of plan it into the future and we say, what is the most efficient model here? Just letting it organically evolve by reaching out to the next service isn't always the right answer. I mean, if that other service is coming from 60 miles away or has a prolonged transport time, it may not be the most efficient model to provide that response.
Some of the other services too, I think this is the case for I believe it's Glover, but I could be wrong about that, is that, you know, some of these emergency squads do take on transport services, and that would be a non-emergency situation where somebody needs to be transported from, the hospital to hospice care or a rehab facility back to home. So it's not an emergency situation, but those are typically, you know, reimbursed by Medicaid or Medicare or by a private insurance or paid for. And so that can be a way to supplement the money coming in to an ambulance squad. And if they're taking on more regional emergency services, does that impact their bottom line?
Well, it does. And I think so ambulance reimbursement in general is paid on a pay-for-service kind of model where you get paid for taking people to the hospital. And yeah, those non-emergency transports are a lucrative way of funding a service. Now, I don't think anybody in EMS is making any money, and I don't think anyone is looking at it from a greedy kind of way. Those non-emergency transports are really important in our system. If you're having a heart attack in a hospital that's not capable of giving you the care you need, you really need to get to that other hospital. So
that would be a pretty big emergency.
Yeah. But the challenge, of course, is those other hospitals are far away, and they take that ambulance out of service for a long period of time. So we as a system have to reconcile the fact that sometimes they're gone and other services have to provide mutual aid, and that can be challenging as well.
On the reimbursement side of things, you know, we hear from doctors and nurses and healthcare providers that they're frequently not reimbursed at the actual cost of services. Is that the case for ambulances as well?
Absolutely. In fact, we have two government reports that say so. What we know is in this pay-for-service model, Again, they're getting paid for the calls they do. But that reimbursement is defined by the federal government. And most of the other payers, indeed the state and also the private payers, are queuing their model on exactly that, those federal guidelines. And regardless of how much it costs, we get a fixed amount back. And that can oftentimes be a significant challenge. And remember also that when
What's the gap? Do you know?
It really depends from place to place and depends on what kind of call we're talking about. There are different levels of reimbursement. But the other thing that I think is really important to consider here is that when you're paid on that pay-for-service model, it doesn't take into account any of the steps you take to be ready. It doesn't take into account any of the training that goes on. It also doesn't take into account any of the patients that you go and care for and don't take to the hospital. So, for example, if an ambulance service goes out to a motor vehicle crash and four people there don't go to the hospital because they're not significantly injured, well, that ambulance still had to have the fuel in it. It still had to have the staffing. It still had to have all the equipment. And that's a non-reimbursable event.
There's also a state tax now. And the idea of this ambulance tax was that it would help draw down some federal funds. But there's been a lot of opposition to that.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't characterize it as a lot of opposition. I think that it's benefited some communities greatly. And it's been not as beneficial as we thought in other communities. But I think on the whole, it was generally a good thing. And I think that the
Explain
model...
Explain how it works. I mean, it is supposed to draw down federal funds, so it should leave communities whole, but in some cases doesn't.
So it's a complicated formula, and in many ways, it depends upon how much of your community is being reimbursed through Medicaid. So basically what we say when it says it works for some places and it doesn't for others, the communities where the Medicaid population is very high get a substantial benefit from it. But the communities where they don't have a high Medicaid population, that's where they see the shortcoming.
Forrest Wyan is executive director of Bennington Rescue Squad and a licensed paramedic, and he joins us in this conversation now as well. Hi, Forrest. Nice to talk with you.
Good afternoon, Jane.
So what is the setup for Bennington Rescue Squad in terms of professional or career EMTs versus volunteers and how that works?
Well, Jane, I will correct you slightly. I do believe that all the EMS agencies are professional, and the terms that we tend to use are career and volunteer. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We do provide 911 emergency service for the three towns here in southwest Vermont. But we also we do provide non-emergency services as well, that type of thing. We provide majority of our staff, actually all of our staff right now, are career folks, either full-time or part-time. We do have volunteer options, but with the staffing levels the way that they are, there's not necessarily volunteers coming in the door.
When you say volunteer levels as they are, they're not coming in the door because you don't need them or because you can't get them?
We really can't get them. So as of right now, just and I know we talked about that a little bit earlier, but as of right now, just with to cover the amount of hours that we have, I could hire probably somewhere in the range of 5 to 7 full-time folks just to cover our needs as of today based on our current call volume and our local hospitals' needs and our local community's needs as far as maintaining ambulance staffing.
You mean you could hire 5 to 7 more than
Absolutely,
you have now?
Yes.
And can you do that? Are there people who are trained, who are ready or want the job?
The well is pretty dry in this area. We've taken on, we worked great with the state, with Dan and his team. We provide our own training, our own classes. There's just not a ton of people getting into this industry. But of course, the economy is really well, so you know, everyone's hiring. But it's a tough job. It's very difficult for us career folks. And even for the volunteers that Mr. Gresser was talking about earlier, there's a lot of expectations. You know, the public expects they see the paramedics and EMTs and firefighters and police on TV, and that's what you expect. You expect an ambulance to show up at your door in 7 minutes and everywhere in Vermont, and the folks that jump off the ambulance all have that high level of training, which a lot of them do. But it takes a lot to maintain that, and it takes a lot to stay competent in those skills. And it's really difficult for folks to do that 4 or 6 hours one night a week, or 4 or 6 hours every 2 weeks, and remain competent and keep your skills up to be able to provide those services.
So, Forrest, when you look at this situation, and, you know, we heard from Joseph Gresser a little while ago talking about what's happening in the Northeast Kingdom and conversations around should it be regionalized, should these services be regionalized so there's maybe one large squad of career EMTs that cover a bigger area, or can we do it with different types of volunteer squads? How do you look at it? What do you think might work?
Well, I think both Joe and Dan were right that you see – I think the first question is what does the community want, and what is the best thing for our citizens or for our area, and you know sometimes that question might be easy to get to, and then the next question I think is the hard one is how do you provide that? Regionalized services are an option. Really strong partnerships are an option. One of the things that we have done this sort of crosses the border into New York, but an agency that was struggling across the border from us that we work with all the time, they came to us and they said, we need help on managing the EMS service. So they provide us, they have access to our management team. Obviously, they pay us a fee for it, but then we provide all the back-end stuff. So the Medicare, Medicaid compliance, managing their service, their fleet maintenance, all the stuff that makes it, that's hard to do. If you're a volunteer, run a volunteer squad, knowing the ins and outs of Medicare law, coordinating your trucks going back and forth to get worked on, maintaining all your staff files, all that type of stuff is very difficult, and all the stuff that's not fun to do in the business world. I mean, that's why we all have back offices to deal with a lot of that stuff. We're able to take that weight off of them to where they can focus on getting volunteers in and staffing their trucks, which is the true working arm of the business. And you know, that's a model that works there. That's a model that we have worked with these partners across the border in New York, but that might not be the best model for other agencies around us. So I think as EMS agencies, we have to be open to looking at those unique solutions and having frank conversations of how can we do this and how can we work together to solve this problem and this need in our communities.
Well, Dan Batesy, Forrest Wyand just said it's not necessarily the right approach for everybody, but it seems like maybe that's a place where the state could step in and say, we can provide some of that back-end support that, I mean, boy, that paperwork is pretty complicated and takes a lot of time.
Yeah, for sure. And I totally agree with Forrest. I think he made a great point. We have a generation of EMTs that are becoming EMT leaders based upon their skill and acumen for being an EMT. And now they're taking on million-dollar budget nonprofit corporations with, in some cases, very little training to do so. And I think what Forrest
– And in some cases, very little oversight, as we saw in WI.
Right, right. And I think what Forrest is describing is this is a very complex job, and not just the clinical side of the job, but the management side of the job. And I think we can do lots to help in that regard. And I think what we've tried to do, what my office has tried to do, is really try to tackle some of those problems and some of those issues. I think there's a lot more to do, and I think when we look at our strategic vision and say, how can we help this problem? I think certainly that has to be on a high part of our agenda.
Forrest, you mentioned that it's difficult to find people to do this job, even if it's going to be your career, even if it's your daily or nightly job. So why do you think it's – I mean, you can make the pitch here. You're the executive director of Bennington Rescue Squad. You're a licensed paramedic. You've been doing this job. Why is it worth it?
It's very rewarding. It is a little bit of a calling. I think it takes a specialized kind of person. To be very frank, a lot of people get into some of these public safety professions for the things you see on TV, the lights and the sirens. And the realistic aspect of it is that, you know, we see people every day in the middle of their worst day at their worst hour. You know, it's at 3 a.m. and they're lying in a bathroom and, you know, in a horrible situation, or their family member is sick or injured. And, you know, we don't have the luxury of, you know, a warm and air-conditioned office or a heated office. You know, if it's raining or the middle of a hurricane or middle of a snowstorm, when you call us, you expect us to be there, and we're going to be out in that. And we're going to provide that high level of care regardless of the day, time, or condition at which you throw us that medical problem or that traumatic issue at us. So I think that it's difficult. It is, you know, not that it's any secret, EMS salaries, you know, actually when you do get over to the actual career side of things, they're not terribly high. You know, you can go to nursing school for a couple of years and come out as a nurse and make a salary significantly higher than a paramedic that goes to an accredited paramedic school and comes out, you know, that's a little bit of a barrier to entry. As far as the physical demands on the job, you know, we, unlike working in a hospital, moving patients aren't necessarily getting any smaller. Moving patients from a stretcher and into an ambulance is a very difficult job, and it's very taxing on the body. So making sure that you have sort of that both mental and physical component is a key component. And I think that some of us get into it thinking it's going to be sort of this glory, exciting job all the time. And just like all jobs have parts that are better and some that are worse. And I think that hurts a little bit as far as the retention piece. You don't realize that you really are that safety net for everybody else all the time.
Well, Forrest Wyan, I appreciate you being on the show and sharing your perspective and what's happening in Bennington. Forrest Wyan is executive director of Bennington Rescue Squad. He's a licensed paramedic. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We're talking with Dan Batesy, who's EMS chief with the Vermont Department of Health. And, you know, Forrest Wyan mentioned that salaries are not high. And in fact, you know, if you're trying to entice people into the medical field, there are a lot of other medical professions like nursing that you can perhaps get a higher salary. You can get a higher degree. You have perhaps more professional movement through the schooling that you get. Is that a problem?
Subsidized tuition through the community college system. There's a lot of inequities there as well. And yeah, it is a problem. I also want to suggest that one of our problems is we're fighting a 40-year history of volunteerism. And a lot of people think that this is just a volunteer job and don't really have the perspective that you can go and get a well-paying job here. There are well-paying EMS jobs out there, but that is
where?
The challenge. Well, I think some of the career departments are paying well. I think that some of the larger services in Vermont are paying a reasonably livable wage. Now, certainly compared to a physician or other, even some high-level nursing jobs, it's not going to be the same. We do have that challenge. But I think you can make a living, and I think what we need to be able to do is try to feed people into those jobs as best we can.
And that question of volunteerism, I mean, you know, I think it was Joseph Gresser mentioned a lot of when these squads were formed, there were more farmers. You know, there were more people who were in a community, especially during the daytime. I mean, I think, you know, nighttime calls are a problem, but people at least are home. They can, you know, pick up their pager and get to the call. If you're at work somewhere in the middle of the day and there's nobody on your volunteer squad who's available to take a call, that's a problem.
It sure is. And that's led to a lot of the the paid staffing that's had to develop in some of these traditionally volunteer ambulances. Yeah, it's not a uniquely EMS problem. I mean, volunteerism is down all across the country in places like the library and the Little League teams too, not just us. I think what's hurt us is the young people demographic of volunteerism, and I think that's changed quite a bit since the original inception of EMS. I think that 18 through 30-year-old group is just not turning out like they once did, and that's a challenge for us. I think there's less of those of that demographic population in Vermont too. I mean, our population is aging, and we're facing that challenge as well.
Yeah, and younger people, maybe, you know, maybe it's a volunteerism problem, not a sense of civic duty, but maybe it's also working two or three jobs. You know, don't have
yeah,
the time.
I don't want to blame the millennials for this problem. I think there's a
they get enough of the blame.
They get enough of the blame, right? But it's a lot of it's multifactorial. There's a lot of different things, and you're right. I think if you have to work two jobs to pay your bills, forget the volunteerism. It's just not going to be there, especially when we're asking you to be up four times at night to go to calls. That's a challenge.
We got a note from Susan in Alstead, New Hampshire, who says, First Branch Ambulance in Chelsea has EMTs check on elderly residents without an emergency situation. My 93-year-old mother is a grateful beneficiary. The EMTs try to make this a weekly event, and they come with equipment, visit for a bit, check and record her blood pressure, answer questions, greet the pets, and scan conditions in the home. That's all while providing cheerful, careful, neighborly attention. Mom always looks forward to the EMT visit. Having a non-emergency relationship with the elderly is a proactive means of watching out for them and valuing their place in the community. Thank you for this opportunity to share good news about a rural ambulance service, she says. I mean, that's quite a service, but I imagine not one that comes with a lot of federal reimbursement.
No, in fact, none. But it is a terrific model, and I think it's a model that represents at least one of the potential solutions that are out there. What she's describing is a concept called mobile integrated health, and it's also known as community paramedics. But the idea being is that the challenge that a lot of the rural communities have is being paid on a call-to-call basis. When you don't have a lot of calls, you don't have a lot of reimbursement. but the expectations are the same, and we expect them to be ready. We expect them to have all of the resources that a busier service would have. What other states have done is develop roles in the community for those paramedics in the time that they're not on emergency calls to impact the public health of the people they serve. So things like the wellness checks that are happening down at First Branch, but also other things, other public health arms. They've worked in opioid relief in communities in New Hampshire. They've done follow-up care in other communities across the country. And really the idea there is to think about a different model where we can begin to stop people from having to go to the hospital. So rather than reacting to these emergencies, let's get into some of the preventative care and save some money that way. So
let's put a final point on this with a note from Amanda, who says, if I call 911, I don't want to fear that the ambulance service isn't coming because they closed or have no crew. What is the state doing to help these small services? And when is it time for the state to step in and start governing the smaller agencies that are floundering because of lack of help, funding, and guidance from the state? So, Dan, in the minute we have left, what about that? But also, is it the state's job or is it local control? Is it small communities that need to take action?
Well, it's both. And we've taken an aggressive role in this. The challenge, of course, is that the communities have to decide what they want, as Forrest said, and we have to educate those stakeholders to know what the right decision is. We're going to give them as much of our time, attention, our impartial opinions that we can do, but at the end of the day, they've got to make the decisions about what kind of care and what kind of response they want.
And maybe townspeople have to pay more money for that? I mean, is that part of it?
Well, in some cases, yeah. As we look to the future, I think that we're not going to have more volunteers tomorrow than we did today. And I think that's a realistic vision that some communities are going to have to face.
That's Dan Batesy, EMS chief with the Vermont Department of Health. Thank you for talking with us about ambulance services around the state. Really appreciate it.